This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Shiloh National Military Park in Tennessee. Come along and join us for a visit with Park Ranger Christopher Miko, who takes us on a walking tour of the historic battlefield and offers fascinating insights about the two-day battle back in April 6th and 7th, 1862. Nearly 110,000 American troops fought in the battle that resulted in more than 23,000 casualties, more than all of America's previous wars combined. The 2 days of fighting did not end in a decisive tactical victory for either side. The Union held the battlefield, but failed to pursue the withdrawing Confederate forces. After the Battle of Shiloh, Union forces proceeded to capture Corinth, Mississippi, and its critical railroad junction, the intersection of the North-South Mobile and Ohio Railroad and the East-West Memphis and Charleston Railroad. The battlefield is named after Shiloh Methodist Church, a small log church near Pittsburgh Landing. Pittsburgh Landing is the point on the Tennessee River where the Union forces landed for the battle, and at the time it was referred to as the Battle of Pittsburgh Landing. Christopher Miko.
Pittsburgh Landing, which is why Grant is here in the first place, early in 1862, the Union Army finally had a success, because 61 hadn't been very good for the Union military. You know, it was pretty much failure after failure. Finally, though, in 1862 in February, General Grant and the Union naval forces are able to take Fort Henry and Fort Donelson, which are up near the Kentucky-Tennessee border. Fort Henry protected the Tennessee River for the Confederates. Fort Donelson protected the Cumberland River, which went to Nashville. Well, now those are both in Union hands. Grant has captured 13,000 Confederate prisoners, which are now headed up north. And now the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers are wide open to invasion by the Union military. Grant, at his disposal, over 110 riverboats, which are all private vessels under contract with the United States military, just like today. And a military contract's always been around. They're using these riverboats to move men and supplies deep into Southern territory. This will be the deepest thrust that they've attempted into Southern or Confederate territory. And the target is the Memphis and Charleston Railroad. That was the only railroad that connected the Mississippi River with the Atlantic Ocean in the entire South. So it is vital for moving supplies and men and communications. So they want to get as deep as they can, and that rail is down in Mississippi, and they want to find a spot so they can offload troops on the western bank of the Tennessee River and then march the rest of the way to that railroad. There's no river that goes directly to it, so they're going to have to do some foot marching. And so they've got to find a landing somewhere to land these troops and establish a base of operations, and that's what Shiloh is, a big Union Army camp. They will say, in fact, Sherman is the one that discovers, William T. Sherman, will discover this landing during an expedition south that doesn't work out, but he realizes, hey, it's been very wet. It was an extremely wet, rainy, early spring of 1862. So everything is flooded, all the rivers, creeks, swamps, ponds, everything is flooded and over their banks. But as Sherman goes down the river, the river flows north here, he realizes this landing, Pittsburgh Landing, is still above the water. And the bluffs, some of these bluffs are 80 to 90 feet above the water also, so he knows even if it continues to flood, the camps will be dry. And the quickest way to disable an army is to get them wet. That will disable your army quicker than bullets of the enemy. So he decides this is the landing, and they start offloading troops here on March 17th. The battle takes place April 6th. In that 3 week, they will offload 38,000 men, all their supplies, all the horse and mule flesh, all the artillery, medical supplies, food. And remember, there's no refrigeration, so how do they get fresh meat here? On the hoof. All that's being offloaded here for this big city they've created. And when I say big city, by April 6th, when the fight takes place, this is the largest city in West Tennessee. Memphis at the time is only 22,000 people. This is 38,000 men, and it grew in 3 weeks. And one thing you really got to think about then is, what did they learn? Quickly, sanitation, big issue. Disease breaks out. Well, let me tell you this. You can only dock 4 boats here at one time, max. These boats are lined up like airplanes circling the airport waiting for a landing spot or in a gate. So those boats are lined up 10 miles down the river waiting to offload their supplies. There's a story about the 71st Ohio. They're a brand new unit. They were issued muskets on the boat ride down here. They are waiting for a spot in the river for 2 weeks, 14 days. What happens in that 14 days? Fresh water supply on the boat runs out. They start drinking out of the Tennessee River. They are 800 men strong. When they offload, 300 men are on the sick rolls. One third of the men are already disabled from that unit. Nothing can disable your army quicker than bad water, but disease. And that's just one example of what's going on. And again, you've got about 44, 45 different individual regiments that are going to be landing here. That's just one story of one of those units. What is Shiloh before the army gets here? It is rural, just like today, a small farming community. You got 30 to 40 families that live in the area. There's no plantations. This is not Natchez, Mississippi, or Charleston, South Carolina. There's no money here. There's no big cotton plantations. There are very few slaves. In fact, the biggest slaveholder in the county is a unionist businessman who lives up in Savannah by the name of William Cherry, who's letting the Grant use his house for the headquarters. And he's a unionist. I always like to say, black and white is easy to pinpoint black and white. There's a lot of, ironically, gray area in the middle when you got the biggest slaveholder in the area is a staunch unionist and helping out the Union Army. These families have plots about 5 to 20 acres at the most. Most crops out here are corn, wheat, and orchards. Apples and peaches do really well here. And because of the apples and the peaches, a couple of distilleries pop up on the river. Up on this bluff up here, there's a general store owned by a guy named Pitts Tucker, where you get Pittsburgh Landing from. Pitts Tucker's general store sells items for the riverboat and to the locals. His number one commodity that he is selling, adult beverage, because of those distilleries and the apples and the peaches. Another big thing that they're raising here, these locals, are hogs. 1860 census, thousands of hogs, and they are all free-range hogs running around in these woods. On the battlefield back then, you're going to see a lot of big trees. None of this underbrush, because the hogs have helped take care of all that. That's the one big difference in the woods that we see today compared to back then, is all the undergrowth and the smaller stuff. Plus, it was such a big old-growth forest that the canopy kept a lot of sunlight from getting down to the floor. So a lot of little stuff couldn't grow down there. Real quick, on the other side, the Confederates, they are massing at the same time down in Corinth, Mississippi. It had been a terrible spring for the Confederates. They got kicked out of Kentucky. They abandoned Nashville, which is the first state capital in the Confederacy to fall, and a huge industrial base that they now lose. They have now been kicked out of Tennessee. They've been pushed all the way back into northern Alabama and northern Mississippi. General Johnston, he actually wants to resign his position, but Davis and the other people won't let him. They still believe in him. President Davis is the biggest supporter of Johnston. He actually said, as you saw in the movie, if he's not our general, we don't have one. He was supposed to be the George Washington for the Confederacy, basically. And that's a pretty high standard to live up to. And he's given an impossible task of protecting the entire Confederacy from the Appalachians all the way to Missouri with very minimal resources, which is one reason the Tennessee River is so wide open. Once Fort Henry falls, they hadn't put any other defenses on this river. They put all their efforts into the Mississippi River. They made a conscious choice, and the Union Army exploited it. Johnston, to him, I won't say that he's desperate, but to him, they've got a strike. The idea is, let's hit this base, this Union Army base, by surprise, destroy it, and hopefully regain Central Tennessee. So there's a lot on the line. Plus, they know if they're not successful in regaining Middle Tennessee, Memphis will be surrounded on three sides and pretty soon will probably fall. And they've already lost Nashville. They don't want to lose Memphis, too. On top of the railroad. So there's a lot on the line here for the Confederates. And this is a pretty bold move, if you will, on Johnston. Something's never been attempted. They are going to try to sneak up here with 44,000 men. Sneak. They're sneaking up. One city is going to sneak up on another city. They almost pulled it off, which is pretty amazing. All right? So that's what's going on. That's why we're here. And the battle takes place here. Really, if it wasn't for the river, nobody would ever have heard of Shiloh, because it's not really good for nothing. The army can't even survive here without bringing in all the stuff. There's really nothing here for anybody except these little... and by the way, a lot of these... We don't have a lot of civilian accounts. This isn't like Manassas, where everybody from D.C. got their picnic baskets and rode out to watch the spectacle. I guess before cable TV, I guess that was a good thing. We're rural, we're isolated, and most of the families here, especially... Let's say you're a father and you've got a bunch of young daughters and a wife. When the Union Army shows up, and it doesn't matter if it's Union or Confederate, armies are not nice things to be around. You know, the big fraternity shows up. 38,000 men, and it is young men away from home. So you got the gambling and the drinking and the cussing and all of that, not to mention the sanitation issues. It doesn't matter your allegiance. This isn't a nice thing to be around. So most of the locals are sent away or go away to other friends' or families' houses to get away from this. So there aren't a lot of local accounts of what goes on here. They're just not here. You know, battle's coming.
So there were no camp followers?
There were. Most of those camp followers are going to be on the Union side, out of the big cities. One of them is Cincinnati. And they're going to be up in Savannah, where the houses are, all right, and the hotels. In fact, there's a story about a unit which has taken over a hotel, and the unit is there with all of the ladies that followed them. When Grant shows up, he puts the kibosh on that immediately. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of civilians that are following up there. And after the battle's over, you got tons of relief aid societies. There's a whole convent of nuns that show up from Cincinnati to help with the wounded. There are wives who have showed up. You got to understand, this is like today, it's an army post. Nobody has any idea there's a battle coming. So wives are traveling down. If you're the wife of an officer, especially if you're from a family of means, yeah, you're showing up. In fact, William Wallace's wife comes here unannounced to surprise her husband, arrives the morning of the 6th, he's already headed towards the front. She can't get off the boat, she offers her services on the boat, because that boat is now going to become a floating hospital, just like that. And of course, he gets mortally wounded that evening, or that afternoon. So yeah, there are some civilians here, but not these locals. Modern-day Shiloh Church, still an active congregation. A lot of the same families that were here 150 years ago, still here today. A lot of them buried here in the cemetery for their generations. A reproduction Shiloh Log Church, built in 2000 by the local Sons of Confederate Veterans. Drawings and sketches and paintings that we have from soldiers that were here. We didn't have the plans, and there's no photographs, but we have the artwork from soldiers that were actually camping here, Union soldiers. And you see that a lot during the Civil War because they don't have cameras. They can't instant message their families back home. They can't send, but they want their families to know what they're going through. And they're here camping and they see this church and they see foliage that they've never seen before up in Wisconsin. They're talking to people who have funny accents and they probably saw the first black people that they've ever seen. So they're writing about this and they're drawing pictures and so forth, sending it up north to their families. And that's how we have the artwork of the church, or we would not know have any idea what it looked like.
So back to the media, there was no Matthew Brady here.
No, this is one thing we do not have, unlike some of the eastern battlefields. We do not have a photographic history of this battle. There are only three known photographs of the battlefield, and they were taken after the fight, of course. Two of them of the landing with boats, and one of them of Madison's battery. And that's it, of siege gun. Which is odd, because nobody would go to the expense and the time to come up here from a city or wherever they came from, probably, you know, maybe out of Corinth, maybe out of Jackson, Tennessee. But it was a huge process with lots of chemicals, lots of expensive equipment, glass plates, etc., along terrible roads, at great expense to the photographer, because they're not going to make anything unless they can sell these postcards or whatever, and only take three pictures. That makes no sense. So a couple of things. Number one, they reused the glass plates, and those pictures are gone forever. Maybe a lot of the glass plates were destroyed in the move by the photographer in his wagon, or they're sitting somewhere, and they just haven't been uncovered yet, wow, which is my hope. But that's, like I said, no Matthew Brady or Gardner. We do not have a photographic history. We have the sketches and drawings from the soldiers that were on the ground and post-battle art by a lot of people that were here or came here. So, yeah, that's one unfortunate part of our history we don't have. So, but the journalists were here, and they did a lot with their pens. And, in fact, speaking of artwork, when Whitelaw Reed wired his version of the Battle of Shiloh story to his Cincinnati paper, an artist there made drawings of what Whitelaw wrote about, and that became the artwork of the battle, which included men being bayoneted in their tents, which never happened. But this is how the legend begins, the folklore of the Battle of Shiloh. And yes, because of the bad media, the negative media for Grant, Grant will be once again in the doghouse after this battle. How could you lose so many men? How could you be surprised? Why didn't you see the writing on the wall? Where were your pickets? Where were your scouts? Why didn't you build any defensive works to be ready for something like this? And he's got an answer for every one of those questions, which is completely military and completely makes sense, and it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback. But after this battle, you see congressional investigation. You see governors coming down here on fact-finding missions, find out what happened to their boys. The governor of Wisconsin comes down here, actually drowns in the Tennessee River after talking to the men. So there are, lots of repercussions after the Battle of Shiloh, as we were talking earlier. And it begins with the questions to Grant. And it starts in Congress, and it goes through the media, and then goes to the public. It is, there are a lot of questions. You know, why did this happen? How did it happen? It's a fascinating story. Some of the monumentation like this is federal government. This is called a mortuary monument. There's only five of them to a corps or division commander that was a brigade killed or mortally wounded on the battlefield. This is Albert Sidney Johnson, but his death site is down in that ravine. And so the commission put this up here so it's next to the road. Most of these roads are all built on the original roadbeds that were here in 62. And then they kept using them, all the farmers. And then when the park was started, those became the park roads. So these were designed and built by the commission and the United States federal government, the War Department, basically the Army, as monumentation to these fallen leaders. Well, this is the only monumentation you're going to see to a leader. Now, if you go to Gettysburg or you go to Vicksburg, you got monuments to generals and colonels and brigade commanders. In Vicksburg, you got monuments to governors of the states that were there. You don't have that here. The only monumentation here is to the units and the soldiers. That was on purpose, not the leaders. The only leaders that are memorialized are these guys that fell in combat or were mortally wounded, like Wallace. You got Johnston, Edley Gladden for the Confederate side, Julius Raith for the Union side, but that's it. No big equestrian statues or anything like that to Johnston or Beauregard or anything like that. This was a park memorialized for the men in the ranks.
It's fairly similar to Chickamauga, isn't it?
Somewhat, yes. Mm-hmm. Chickamauga, and like, we're so close in time also, but yeah. It is said that Johnston probably got hit on that rise on the other side of the road. It is the highest elevation in this area of the fight. The enemy is across the field in a line of battle, so that would have been his best vision to see to view what's going on, to direct the operations. He had just sent all of his couriers and staff members, like Harris, out to tell all the brigade and regimental commanders to move forward now. So he was alone for maybe a minute or two, and that's when he got hit, 58 caliber mini ball, right behind the right knee. He did not know that where he had been hit. He just knew that he wasn't feeling right. He had been in a duel in Texas prior to the Mexican War, and when he got hit in the right buttocks, if you will, and it severed his sciatic nerve, the ball did. So he didn't have any feeling in his right leg. So when he got hit over there, he didn't know that he had been hit or how bad it was, and it severed his artery, and he started bleeding out. So he started bleeding out, and Isham Harris, the governor, was the first one to come back and find him. Again, he's over in that on that rise, we feel. He's already pale. I've talked to EMTs and paramedics. If that artery does get severed like that, you've got maybe about 7 minutes. That's what I've been told, depending on how large of a person. And Johnson's a big dude. I mean, he's about 6'2", 6'3", hefty, you know, big, stocky. Not fat, but just big guy. So he's bleeding out. Harris will lead his horse over into this general area, and that's why the monument is here. They get him down off the horse. The other staff members show up like you might have seen in the movie. They look for the wound. The first thing they do is look at his head and his torso, most obvious. Tear his shirt off. It can't find anything. And he's getting worried. He finally goes unconscious. And he's mainly bleeding internally, which is why they don't see anything initially. And they take him down in that ravine and he perishes about 2:30. And there's a funny, interesting story that goes on after his death. Because Beauregard is on the other side of the battlefield. And Beauregard's now in charge. Johnson's gone. And Johnson was also in charge of this sector of the battlefield, so somebody's got to come over here and take over. And to not get into it, Johnson should not have been doing what he was doing at his rank. I'll just leave it there. But that's one of those things. One of the staff members gets on Fire Eater, which is Johnson's horse, who has been hit 4 times but will survive the war. And then he's stolen later by a Yankee from an Arkansas farm. And we don't know what happened to him. But anyway, this staff officer rides Fire Eater to the church area where we were. That's where Beauregard has set up his headquarters. And tells Beauregard, you know, Johnson's dead. You're now in charge. Okay. Another staff member that didn't know the first one went, a couple minutes later, gets on his horse and rides to Beauregard and says, Johnson's dead. You're now in charge. Then, this is where the controversy starts. Isham Harris gets on his horse and rides to Beauregard, because he doesn't know about the first two, to tell Beauregard, Johnston's dead, you're now in charge. Beauregard already knows this information. He's dealing with other issues. He's been told twice. He's already been processing this in his head. He doesn't have time to mourn, obviously. They're in the middle of something pretty major. He is funneling all the reserves where they got to go, and he's getting all the information from the front where he is. So Beauregard replies to Isham Harris, yes, but everything else seems to be going well. Harris takes that as an affront. Johnston is one of his good friends. Beauregard has always been looked at with a little bit of suspicion, like the reason he came out here was take over. And Beauregard's got that personality. And that charisma about him, he is the biggest hero in the South. He's the only one that's really won a lot of stuff, Fort Sumter, Manassas. So Harris continues that story that Beauregard wasn't taking the death too seriously, and that this shows that to him that Beauregard had always wanted command of the army, and now he's got it. But it's not the truth. It really isn't the truth. In fact, before this fight, Johnston actually offers command of the army to Beauregard, and Johnston was going to be the commander of the theater. And Beauregard said no. In no uncertain terms, this is your army. Davis gave it to you. I'm not going to do that. So if he would have wanted it, he could have got it before the fight. He didn't want to get it this way, I don't think. The monument on our right is the tallest one on the battlefield, the Iowa State Monument. I like to say there's two stories about Shiloh. You got the battle, and then the creation of the park. And really, the veterans are part of both of that. When the park was created, the Park Commission put out a call saying to the states, if you had a unit that fought here, you can put a monument on the battlefield, but you have to pay for it. The state does. And it has to be appropriate, meaning, you know, honorable and all that. And all the text on it has to be historical. It cannot be, you cannot say bad things about the enemy. You cannot highly praise a unit beyond what they did, that kind of thing. It has to be completely, accurately historical. Iowa spent a lot of money. Obviously, they put up a monument for each individual unit and a big state monument to every soldier who fought here. And that is Lady Fame. She is carving into the stone the deeds of the Sons of Iowa, so nobody will ever forget. And she is bare-breasted, which represents all the mothers whose sons never came home. These monuments from this era, you know, everything on the monument means something. It's very symbolic and is trying to tell you a bigger story.
Would you mind talking for a moment? This is an element that is missed sometimes, and that is the day, the moment when these monuments in front of us were unveiled. Many people don't realize it. How many Civil War veterans were standing right here in the ceremonies that took place?
Right, and that was a very big deal. The state representatives would come down. Usually a commander of one of the units or the Grand Army of the Republic. Sometimes you would see governors because they had to officially turn the monument over to the federal government.
But literally, there might have been 1,000 men right here.
When they unveiled the Confederate Memorial in 1917, the estimate of the crowd was 35,000 people.
And of that, how many veterans?
A huge amount. But they, of course, were bringing their families because they wanted to see and tell the families, the grandchildren, what they had done here. The last monument where veterans actually attended was the unveiling of the Michigan Monument in 1912. So that was really the last of the Northern veterans coming down here. But for a lot of these monuments, like the Iowa Monument, this was 1906-07, the Ohio Monuments, 1903. Yeah, you had hundreds of veterans, and some of them coming by, most of them by riverboat from points far north in the Midwest. So this was a big trip and a big deal. So yeah, it was amazing. But the veterans were doing this to recall what they had done and to be able to pass along to the next generations what had happened here. And that's why veterans were also running the park. All the commissioners were from the armies that had fought here. And that was part of the legislation that created the park. Deemed that that was how the park was going to be operated until that generation went away. And that's what happened. So, and all the three armies, the Confederate Army and the two Union armies that fought here, all had representation. Everyone got their say.
After the Civil War, a lot of U.S. Army military bases that were opened, as you well know, were named in honor of Confederate generals, Fort Hood, etc. On the commissions subsequent to the Civil War, was there a great effort to loop in the Southerners, the Southern veterans, on the commissions?
Oh, yes. It was required. And the Army of the Mississippi, which was the Confederate Army that fought here, that was their moniker, they had to be represented by an officer from the Army of Tennessee. One of the initial commissioners was Colonel Robert Looney, who had fought here commanding the 38th Tennessee Infantry for the Confederate Army. So yes, everyone was supposed to be represented according to the congressional legislation. Now the Confederate Memorial, this is unveiled in 1917. The little old ladies of the United Daughters of the Confederacy were very upset because northern states were spending tons of money putting northern monuments all over the battlefield, but nobody was doing that for the Confederates. And the reason was because of the dire economy in the South post-Civil War into the 1900s. So the UDC started fundraising campaigns, was able to raise about $50,000, which is well over $500,000 today. Ironically, contracted with an artist from Chicago to design the monument. And that's what you see in front of us. And there's a whole story that is playing out in front of us without any words. If you look at the ladies in the center, the very center lady up there, that is Victory. But she has got her head down and she's handing her crown off to the lady to her right. She has defeated Victory. The Confederates lost the battle, of course. She's handing her crown off to a lady that represents Knight. A lot of Southerners felt if they would have had more daylight, they could have finished the job on the first day, wouldn't have lost the battle on day two. That's speculation. And that wasn't the only problem the Confederate Army had, but that's what a lot of Southerners felt, especially at the time, at the beginning of at the turn of the century. The lady to her left is Death in her mourning attire. The four soldiers, two on either side of the statue, represent the different branches of the military. On our left, you see the gentleman with the saber in his hand out. He represents one of the cavalry soldiers, one of the horsey soldiers. He has his hand out because he wants to help, but he can't. They just cannot maneuver in the dense woods with all the ravines and the flooded creeks and swamps. So the cavalry is here, but they really don't play a role in the battle. The gentleman behind him with his head down represents one of the officer corps. He has lost the battle. He really and lost a lot of good men, and his head is down and in defeat. The soldiers on our right, you've got the infantry soldier in front with his musket and a flag in his hand. He won't get rid of that. He won't let that flag go. And then behind him, one of the artillery soldiers with his sponge hammer. So those are the men that fight here in relief. The gentleman's profile right below the ladies, that is the General Albert Sidney Johnston, the highest ranking American officer ever killed in combat, period. And of course, a lot of Southerners, especially people like President Jefferson Davis, really felt that Johnston was the man. This is our George Washington. He can lead us to our second American Revolution to gain our independence. Really how they looked at it, and Johnston was the leader. He felt they could do this, and of course, when Johnston fell, to this day, a lot of people still believe that might have been the end, and this is pretty early. You know, this is only 1 year into the war. To really come to that conclusion this early in the conflict is a pretty big deal for Southerners. The gentleman you see in relief to either side of the lady represent the 2 days of fighting. On the right, the soldiers are marching with their heads up. They're marching north. They're pushing Grant towards the river. They're winning, if you will. On the left is April 7th. Their heads are down. They're headed south. They're falling back to Corinth. They've been defeated. As you can see, there aren't any words up there. There's no movement. There's a huge story going on in front of us.
In the bas-relief figures, the heads, are any of them based on real people?
No. Not that we know of, but there is symbolism because there are 11 rows of soldiers marching, and that represents all the states in the Confederacy. Even though they all weren't represented here in the fight, they're represented on the monument. That the little old ladies from the UDC wanted the monument here. A lot of folks feel this is the high water mark, if you will, for the Confederates in the battle, because in the woods right behind the monument is where General Benjamin Prentiss was captured. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon on April 6th.
And what happened to him for the rest of the war?
Well, he is exchanged in the fall. The exchange system is still going on. He's held as a pretty VIP house arrest sort of prisoner down in Jackson, Mississippi. But all of those prisoners, all those POWs that survive captivity, some of them are wounded and don't make it or get sick. But all the ones that survived, they're exchanged by the fall, along with Prentiss. Prentiss, though, is his own worst enemy. He's not a military man. He's not a professional soldier, although he did see action in the Mexican War. He's a politician, and politician has one job, get reelected. Prentiss takes the position that his holding of the Hornet's Nest allowed Grant time to reorganize and prevented the ultimate disaster, which would have been the defeat of the Union Army here. So Prentiss really takes it upon himself to give himself all the credit. And he likes to talk to the media, and the journalists love to get the scoop. And He is giving interviews, even while he's a POW, to anybody who will listen, that basically he was the savior of the Union Army at Shiloh. There's one person, though, that really doesn't have time for that. And that's General Grant, who is 100% military. Obviously doesn't believe. There was a lot of factors that took place on April 6th that saved, if you will, the Union Army.
Did Grant shut him down?
Let's just say this. By the time Halleck is promoted to Chief of the Army by Lincoln, which is a made-up title that didn't exist, Lincoln wanted Halleck out of the field. He wasn't a field officer. And wanted Grant back in charge of this Western Army because he fights. By the time you get Halleck in Washington and Grant is back in charge of the Army in the West, they start to weed out all the political generals. By the time Vicksburg falls, it is a professional officer corps that is leading the Union Army, mostly West Pointers. So people like Prentiss and McClernand have been pushed to the periphery. Even though they're great recruiters, which is why they got their stars in the first place, in the field, no. No, not in the field.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.